We've come quite a ways through the book of 1 Corinthians so far. We've covered a lot of ground, and I don't want to really rehash everything we've gone over. We understand that the first several chapters, Paul addresses the issue of division that was apparently one of the foundational problems at the congregation in Corinth. Then in chapter 5, Paul begins addressing some specific issues that were taking place at the congregation. First of all, in chapter 5 was a case of immorality, a particularly heinous form of immorality. But really, what distressed Paul was not so much the deed itself. It was terrible. The man's situation was terrible. But Paul was appalled there by the way they were treating the situation, the way that they tolerated the situation. But then, in contrast to their gross tolerance of a clear sin, in chapter 6, he began showing another case of improper judgment, whereas they wouldn't tolerate one another and they wouldn't let one another or let themselves be defrauded, but apparently were actually some of them taking other brethren to court and cases of litigation. And so we have these two extremes, both of which are clearly wrong. And then in chapter 6, verse 12 through 20, which we discussed this past Wednesday, was a passage where Paul goes back to the sin of fornication. Specifically prostitution, but sexual immorality at large, and shows the grave seriousness of sexual sin and of immorality. Now, we have to remember that as we start going into chapter 7, the background of immorality. Now, one of the things that a lot of commentators try and do is they try and reconstruct fully exactly what the situation at Corinth was. And the truth is, we're 2,000 years removed, and we cannot fully, I don't think, reconstruct everything that took place and every attitude that they had and every view that they took. We get a lot of clues and a lot of ideas, but it's impossible to fully reconstruct the entire situation. So we have to take what we have and remember all these pieces as we work. But what's interesting is Paul seems to be addressing an element at the end of chapter 6 that had this very flippant view towards sin, and in particular, towards sexual sin. It seems from the reading that there may have been some that justified going and visiting the prostitutes that were there in Corinth, or living in sin, because they thought that was just a form of bodily pleasure. And since we are, after all, spiritual beings, the body really does not matter. But then in chapter 7, Paul is going to use what he has built upon in chapter 6, where he has proven that sexual sin is a terrible thing, that it's a dangerous thing, and that he has shown why. And then he's going to use that to make some of his points in chapter 7. But the points in chapter 7, in some way, seem to be pointed at a different group of people. Remember, there is a great deal of division in Corinth, and I can't help but wonder if we see that here, because you have one group of people that looks at sexual sin as flippant and something that they don't think is wrong. And what we're going to see in the very beginning of chapter 7 is people that look at sexual relations as lower or base or less spiritual or maybe even sinful, even in the confines of marriage. And so they had gone to another extreme of complete denial. You might call it asceticism, which is just a denial of all sorts of things. And they took that type of view towards physical intimacy, even in the bonds of marriage, which, once again, was too far on the other extreme. And so Paul's going to correct that. But Paul is going to use this opportunity to now shift into a lot of the questions that the Corinthians had for him. So see in verse 1, he says, "Now concerning the things which I wrote to you," we've discussed several times throughout our studies from the introduction on that it seems the Corinthians had written a letter to Paul. There was some back and forth conversation that was already taking place by the time this letter was written. And Paul has been addressing some things he has heard about them from Chloe's household and perhaps from others. And now he is going to specifically address some of either their questions that they posed to him or some of the statements that they made towards him in their letter. And he's going to use this as the springboard here in chapter 7. Which chapter 7, for the most part, is going to be an entire chapter devoted to questions about marriage. And he's going to address a lot of specific groups as he goes through this chapter. Here's a kind of an outline of chapter 7, if you will. The first 7 verses have to deal with married couples. And specifically, this problem that there were some that were seeming to abstain from sexual relations, even in their marriage. So Paul addresses that issue. But next, in verses 8 and 9, he shifts to specifically the unmarried and the widows. He then goes back to the married, but for a different purpose, to discuss the topic of divorce with 2 groups of people: Christians that were married to Christians, and then Christians that were married to non-Christians. Then we have the middle of the chapter, which is kind of interesting because it's the one portion of the chapter that is not specifically about either sexual relations or marriage at large, and yet it is still, in the same sense, the theme of the whole chapter. Because it is there that Paul really states the theme of this chapter, which is live as you are called. Now, he gives some teaching to servants and to slaves to bring that point out. But that point is really the point that Paul makes throughout all of the chapter, to the married, to the unmarried, to the very circumstances that he'll address. That is essentially the point that Paul makes. But with each point, he also offers typically an exception that is qualified to some extent. And so after that kind of middle part that is the anchor of the chapter, he then addresses some more groups. He specifically addresses virgins in verses 25 through 38, and then wives and widows in verses 39 through 40. Now obviously I'm not going through all of that tonight. I'm going to begin in verse 1, and either in this sermon or in this sermon, and Lord willing, another sermon, if I need to, we'll get through verses 16. Then James will take the next section. And then I believe Brother David will finish up this chapter. But the chapter at large needs to be remembered together. And so try and really remember the things we talk about. And after tonight's sermon, go home and read this passage and the rest of the chapter as well. And do that as we go throughout this chapter. And I think it will help out a great deal. And one thing I'll also say before we launch in, I don't want to belabor these introductory remarks. But we also need to be very careful with chapter 7. In a sense, Paul is giving instructions about marriage. He is providing instructions about marriage. But we should not look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7 as the full theological discourse concerning marriage. There have been a lot of problems. There have been a lot of abuses. There have been laws made that are not there. And there have been exceptions found that also are not in the text through chapter 7 for all sorts of situations in marriage that I don't think are warranted. And we'll discuss some of those as we go through these passages. But okay, questions about divorce and remarriage, all sorts of ideas that people have come up with throughout the years in the church, but especially out in the denominational world, because people have misused this chapter. So it's a very important chapter. It's a good chapter, but it's also a chapter that we need to be very careful with and diligent with, that we look at the context, we apply the passages within their context, and we don't wrestle the scriptures out of the context to try and justify or teach something that we want it to, but actually isn't really there. So jumping in verse chapter 7 and verse 1, as I mentioned, Paul says, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." So Paul, this phrase "now concerning" shows up several times throughout the rest of the letter. Simply marks a transition point, a very clear transition. And now he's transitioning to a new topic, but also to the things that they had written to him in their letter. But then he says, "It is good for a man not to touch a woman." This is similar to some of the issues that we had in chapter 6, verses 12 through 20. And the same question arises here as it did there. Is Paul saying this? Or is Paul quoting a Corinthian idea or saying? And that's a fairly important question in this chapter, because how you answer that question will probably play have a large role in how you view and interpret the rest of the chapter. If this is Paul saying it is good for a woman, for a man not to touch a woman, then you have to look at the rest of the chapter in the context that Paul views it as good, which can mean expedient or can also mean morally right to remain abstinent. And so, and that is maybe higher or a higher spiritual plane than those that have married. If, however, it is the Corinthians that have come up with this idea or slogan, then we can see Paul's comments in a different text. So how do we determine whether this is Paul or whether these are the Corinthians that have this idea, it is good not to touch a woman? And quite clearly there, by the way, some translations say it is good for a man not to marry. Frankly, that's a watered-down translation when they do that. The idea of touch, when he says this is a euphemistic way of Paul referring, or the Corinthians referring, to sexual relations. That's what the context is in this passage. And now, but it is within the marriage, or within the confines of marriage. Paul's not talking about sexual relations at large. He has already shown fornication is sinful. So the question is now, we know fornication is sinful, but is sex okay and good in marriage? Or should even that be abstained from? Well, to really answer, I think we have to look at the scripture at large. What does the rest of the Bible say about marriage and the sexual relationship that comes with marriage? Well, go all the way back to the beginning in Genesis 2, where we find portion of the creation account. Remember what God said about man. He said, it is not good that man should be alone. And because of that, God created Eve. He created woman. And he instituted marriage. He gave Eve to Adam. And he said, henceforth or therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. God said in the very beginning, it is not good for man to be alone. So it's hard to see from the very beginning that if God says it's not good for man to be alone, that we should come along and say, well, actually, it is good, it is morally right for a man to just fully abstain from a woman, or for a woman to completely abstain from a man, and place that on some higher spiritual plane. But also Hebrews 13 and 4 says, marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. You know, those two passages alone give us an idea that marriage is not a band-aid for a problem that mankind has with fornication. Some people think that's what Paul is teaching. That Paul is saying, you know, because you can't control yourselves, and because you'll commit fornication if you don't, go ahead and be married if you have to. But really, that's not the greatest situation. The greatest situation is if you can just abstain altogether. But Hebrews 13 and 4 says that marriage is honorable, and there's nothing defiling about the bed or the sexual relationship in marriage. And God said it's not good for man to be alone. But Paul himself in other places shows a very high regard for marriage. In Ephesians 5, verse 22 through 33, we've considered some of these verses recently in our study about the role of husbands, and Lord willing, we'll consult these verses again when we have the opportunity to speak about the role of wives. But remember, what does Paul do in Ephesians chapter 5? Paul equates or correlates the marriage relationship of the husband and wife to the relationship of Christ and the church. Now, if Paul did not hold a high view of marriage, how in the world, why in the world, would he equate such with Christ and the church? There's not a higher standard that he could have set or paralleled marriage with than with Christ and the church. We also see in 1 Timothy 4, when he was telling Timothy about a coming apostasy, about people that would reject the truth and people that would rebel and apostatize from the faith, he said that one of the signs of this coming apostasy is that they would forbid to marry. Forbidding to marry was not ever spoken of in the Bible, in the New Testament, as something that was morally pure or morally better. Forbidding to marry was a sign of apostasy and rebellion. And that has happened. You know, think of, we know of denominations that refuse marriage to certain classes of people. It's exactly fulfilling what Paul had talked about. That doesn't make a person morally better or spiritually more pure because of that. And also, lastly, in 1 Timothy 5, verse 14, if Paul had a very low view of marriage and really thought that it was not the best situation, then why would he give the positive command that he desired the younger widows he addresses in 1 Timothy 5 to marry? Now, all of this taken into account, I think the proper understanding of this is the phrase, "it is good for a man not to touch a woman," is not Paul's opinion. I think that is the Corinthian opinion, or at least the opinion of a segment of Corinth. Now, there are a couple of nuances in which Paul will agree to an extent, but they will always be highly clarified and qualified, as we'll see throughout our study. But by and large, I think Paul's answer to this is going to be no. That's not right. And he's going to make the argument, I think, throughout the case, that the individual who is celibate or is able to remain unmarried for various reasons and thus stays not attached to an individual through marriage and thus is also sexually abstinent, he's going to say there are good things about that, but that person is not automatically more spiritual or more righteous just because they are not married and thus are not engaged in a sexual relationship. That's the argument that Paul will make and show throughout these passages. So keep that in mind, that this is the Corinthian idea, because this is going to probably affect why some were seeking a divorce, even amongst Christians and especially amongst non-Christians. This really lays the foundation for these first 16 verses that Paul talks about. But going into verses 2 through 4, he begins to answer the question immediately. He says, "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does." Now, Paul's, as I already mentioned, essential answer to the Corinthian question or statement of, is it good or it is good to that a man should not touch a woman? Paul's answer, quite simply, is no. That is incorrect. And Paul gives a threefold argument or an explanation why it's incorrect. And again, we'll make this point a time or two because it's very important to understand here. This is speaking in the context of marriage. Paul has already affirmed that outside of marriage, yes, it is morally pure for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman because he has no right to when he is not married to the woman. The context of verse 7 is not sexual relations, or chapter 7 here is not sexual relations at large, but within the marriage. And I think I can show that through the text here. But anyway, Paul answers this question, and Paul clarifies it with really three arguments here in verses 2 through 4. First of all, the reason that this argument is not correct is because of the danger of sexual immorality, which he states in verse 2. Now, Paul has already, remember, chapter 6, verses 12 through 20, sexual immorality is a heinous sin. It's a dangerous sin. Paul has shown how grave it is. So if we understand how grave a sin it is, we should be very careful not to put ourselves or those, especially that are our spouses, into situations where they would be tempted to commit such a heinous sin. And so Paul says that because of sexual immorality, this position of the Corinthians does not hold up. Now, some people find here that Paul has a very low estimation of marriage. Some people accuse Paul of viewing marriage as nothing more than protection against fornication. That's not what Paul's doing. Again, remember the passages we've already cited, Ephesians chapter 5, and the rest of what Scripture has to say about marriage and the relationship that comes along with it. Paul does not think that marriage is nothing more than a way for us to avoid temptation of sexual sin. But the truth remains, we are human beings. Men and women both have sexual desires and appetites. That is not wrong or sinful. God created us. He created those desires. He created those appetites. But He gave us means by which those appetites and desires are to be met, and that is through marriage. Those desires and appetites become lustful and become sinful when we seek to gratify them outside of God's plan. That's when sexual relations become fornication in all of its various forms. And yes, that is sinful. But back to the point, the truth is, we are human beings. We have those desires. We have those appetites. And that's not wrong in and of itself. But if we misuse those appetites, or if we put ourselves or others into situations that tempt them to act upon those appetites in sinful ways, then clearly there is a great danger there. And so Paul says to avoid that danger, married couples should have a sexual relationship. Now that phrase, when he says that let a man have his own wife and let a woman have her own husband, it's easy to read that and think that Paul is speaking about get married to avoid fornication. Remember, that's not the context. Paul does not say get you a wife to avoid fornication in this passage. What he says is to avoid fornication, let a man have, and the Greek implies to be having or keep having. It is something that should be taking place and is to continue to take place, not something that he says begin doing. He's saying to avoid fornication, let a man have sexual relations with his wife and the wife with her husband. He's saying that your viewpoint that it's good not to touch a woman, that it's good to abstain from this type of relationship of physical intimacy in marriage, he says, no, that's wrong. In fact, to avoid fornication, the opposite is true. A husband and a wife should have a physically intimate and active relationship. Now also, by the way, by implication, this teaches the idea of monogamy. Notice the singular nature here as well as throughout the rest of the chapter. Paul speaks very singularly of a husband and his wife and a wife and her husband. So by implication, we see monogamy. It's not the main thrust of the passage, but I did think that we should make that point as well. But the second argument, not only because of sexual immorality, but Paul now shows the wrong attitude that they had, but secondly, because affection should be viewed as the spouse's due. Affection, if you're reading the New King James, and I believe the King James, other translations have it differently, is kind of, again, a euphemism. In fact, some translations even just put in there conjugal rights, and that is a proper translation of the word that is here. But what Paul is saying is that sexual relations are actually to be viewed as something due to the spouse. It's not something that we expect or that we view as due us. It's something that we view due to the spouse. Now, this should not cause an attitude of grudging obligation, but instead an attitude in the marriage of loving service, as in all areas of marriage, not just the physical, but the spiritual and the mental as well. The overriding idea and attitude of the husband should be what serves, uplifts, upbuilds, and pleases his wife. And the wife's attitude should be what serves, pleases, upbuilds, and uplifts her husband. The idea, the focus, is on what is to be given, not what is to be taken or had. So what we see is sex is not a weapon that a spouse, either man or woman, can rightfully wield as a weapon of power. Neither should we view it as a gift that we give to the spouse only when we are pleased and only when we get our way. Instead, that physical relationship is actually something we are indebted, that we owe to our partner. Now, Paul clearly states that this is a two-way street. In fact, in all of this chapter, which is very different than most commands you have in the Old Testament or in most secular sources about this idea, Paul always refers to the husband and the wife in this instance. He doesn't use just one and assume that we apply it to both cases. He makes it very clear. He speaks to the husband and the wife throughout this entire passage. Wives are to be conscious of their husband's needs. Likewise, husbands should focus on their wives' needs. And we all understand that needs vary in many ways, physically, emotionally, mentally, and in many other ways. The key is our concern is how we serve our partner and our spouse. But the third argument, which is found in verse 4, builds upon this. And Paul says that for your body is not your own. The husband's body is his wife's, not his. She has authority over his body. And likewise, he has authority over her body. In other words, our body is not ours to do with as we please in marriage. Our body is our spouse's. When we become one flesh in marriage, it means that we serve the needs of our spouse, not ourselves. The world looks at sex as what one can get. That is lust. The Christian should view sex in marriage as what one can give. This is love. It is possible for a Christian to even have a lustful attitude about sexual relations, even within marriage, when the focus is simply on themselves and not in the right attitude of caring for the spouse. But since the body is not our own, again, that means that we cannot rightfully withhold affection. We cannot rightfully withhold physical intimacy as a punishment or again as a means to get our way. It also means, by the way, that neither the husband nor the wife has the right to join their body to another outside of marriage. Remember, the body is not your own. The body is the spouse's. And we should respect that as such. And for this threefold reason, Paul shows that the idea that it is right for me to withhold physical intimacy from my spouse because I feel like that makes me more spiritual or more pure fails on at least three reasons. One, because it puts my spouse and probably myself into temptation to commit fornication. Secondly, it's not my right to do so because it's not my body to say that. It's my wife's body. And thirdly, because that affection is due to the spouse. And so for me to withhold it would be the same as reneging on the payment, if you use those terms that Paul does of due. That's the idea he wants to get across in our minds. Now from here, he goes into a possible exception. Remember I said there are some exceptions that Paul lists. And here is the one to this first one. And it's a hypothetical situation. It's a possible exception. And I think verse 6 shows that it is hypothetical. And Paul is not commanding this exception in any way. In verses 5 and 6 he says, "Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment." So again, Paul's primary answer to the Corinthian question of is it good to abstain from sex even in marriage is no. In fact, he gives the command, "Do not deprive one another." But he gives a small exception here. He says there is one possible exception to this rule that we should not deprive one another. There's one case where abstinence, even amongst married couples, is permissible. Now notice I say permissible. It is allowed. It is not commanded, but it is allowed. And he also gives some very strict qualifications as to when this abstinence amongst married couples is allowed to take place. First of all, it must be of mutual consent. Both partners, both husband and wife, must consent to the period of abstinence in their marriage before they can go into this period of time. Secondly, it must be for a limited time. It would not be right, and Paul says it is not permissible, for a husband and wife to say we feel we would be more spiritual or higher or better off if we just said from this point on, we never have a physical relationship again. We just have a spiritual marriage. That's not within the scope of what Paul allows here. He says that it must be for a short time or for a period of time. Thirdly, it must be for a spiritual purpose. Paul says that it should be for the purpose of prayer. Now, this is not commanded. And some people have gotten this mixed up. And again, they see here that Paul's saying, you know, if you want to have a prayerful life, that should be a life of when it comes to sexual relations with one's wife, even an abstinent one. Now, in the Old Testament, there were times where they were given commands before they could come to a certain place or appear before the mountain, where God would say, make sure that none of the men lie with the woman for at least 3 days. Or you find a few of those purification scenes in the Old Testament. But that's not true in the New Testament. We don't find that as a requirement in the New Testament. Paul's not saying if you want to have a prayer life, you have to be abstinent. Paul's saying the only time that you can be abstinent in this marriage relationship is when for a specific purpose, for some reason, you and your spouse feel like you want to give yourself over to an intense focus on just spiritual things. It's very similar to fasting. You know, we might look at a situation, maybe there's a very difficult circumstance we're dealing with. Maybe there's a problem. Maybe there's a concern. Maybe there's something that we really want to spend time just focusing in prayer and reading God's Word and put out all other distractions. And so we decide to fast for maybe a short period of time during the day, maybe a day, maybe a couple of days. Well, that's the idea that Paul is saying here. It needs to be for a spiritual purpose. But he's not saying in order to be spiritual, you have to go through this process. But it does mean that we don't just part from one another just for any old reason, or because we're angry at one another, or for something along those lines. It is for a very spiritual purpose. And then fourthly, and this really is just a repeat of number two, but it must come to an end. He says, and then come together again. So this period that is separated to fasting or to prayer, I should say, is to come to an end. It's to be temporary. It's not to be perpetual. And Paul explains why. He says, come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Paul points out an interesting paradox in their idea. Their idea is, well, if we remain sexually abstinent, we prove ourselves to be more spiritual. We prove ourselves to be on a higher spiritual or righteous plane. Paul says, you put yourself right in the devil's crosshair, and in your thought that you're becoming more spiritual, you're probably going to end up sinning. That's what he says. He says, that's why you come back together. Because if you don't, that is a foothold that Satan can gain in one or both persons' lives to tempt them with what? With fornication. Remember how tempting it is. Remember how dangerous it is from chapter 6. Paul says you do not put your spouse in that situation and you don't put yourself in that situation. Otherwise, this time that we've given to ourselves to become more spiritual might actually lead to our own temptation and to our sin if we're not careful. And then he says in verse 6, but I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. Some people put this with verse 7. Some people apply this to all of what has been said so far. I think the best rendering of verse 6 is to apply it to what he has said just here in verse 5. This exception that he has given, he is allowing. Remember, his argument has been no. Your idea that it's right to withhold sexual relations from one another in marriage is incorrect. That's wrong. He says, but by permission, there is this one circumstance that is highly qualified. But it is only a permission. It is not a command. A husband and a wife might live out their entire marriage without going through such a situation and scenario as we just described of devoting themselves to prayer and abstinence during such a period of time. They might go their entire marriage and not go through that. And that's okay because it's not commanded of a husband and a wife to do that. Now, moving on in verse 7, this is kind of an end to the argument so far. He says, for I wish that all men were even as I myself, but each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. Now, Paul at this time, we'll see this throughout the remainder of what we talk about in this passage. At this time, Paul was single. Paul was unmarried. Now, whether Paul was unmarried because he was a widower or because he never was married is a subject of great debate amongst people. And the truth is, we don't know. We can all have our opinions. I have my opinion, and it really doesn't matter, and it doesn't apply, because at this point, Paul is unmarried. And not only is he unmarried, but Paul feels that he is able to continue living in an unmarried state of affair and not feel overly burdened or overly tempted in such a state. And that's what he is addressing here. But now some people have taken this again to say that Paul is again alluding to, okay, well, if you have to get married, but I wish that everybody was just celibate like me. I wish everybody was as spiritual as me and could just be celibate. Well, I think that misses the point. Paul does not elevate the celibate to a higher spiritual plane than to those that are married. One of the best comments I saw on this was from the commentator C.K. Barrett in Harper's New Testament Commentaries. I'm not going to read all of that at this time. If you want to read that kind of in the background while I'm talking, feel free to. But basically, Barrett's point, what he argues, is that Paul is saying he desires that men, his desire is not that men be celibate. His desire is that men and women be free of fornication and be free of the temptation to commit fornication. He makes a very intriguing argument because the word that Paul uses, he translates, I desire. The New King James says, for I wish, is very specific. In other places in Paul's letters, when he displays some wish that is impossible, he uses a different term. He uses different terminology. So if Paul was saying, I wish that all men were like me, but not all men can be, he would have used a different term than he did here. The term he uses for I desire or I wish, as Barrett points out, is very close to a command. It's something he thinks is and expects to be attainable. But now not everybody can be celibate like Paul. So how can he expect it? He can expect it if his expectation is not celibacy, but freedom from temptation of fornication. There's two ways that that can happen. One way is an individual can be naturally gifted without the desires that would lead them to fornication. And Paul views it as just that, a gift. He calls his ability to live unmarried and without fulfilling physical desires a gift. Paul did not come to that state of being because he was more spiritual. Paul was not celibate because he was more righteous. He had not worked long and hard to discipline himself to do without. He says this was just a gift from God. Remember Jesus' words, I don't have the passage, but he speaks about those who are made eunuchs by men and men who are born eunuchs. He's simply speaking about there are men, there are women that are born, and as they grow, they just don't have the same desires that other people have. Doesn't mean they're weird. It doesn't mean that they're anything about that. It just means that they're able to control that desire better than others can. What about those that don't have that gift? They have a different gift. They have the gift of marriage. Paul views both as a gift. Paul views both as something given by God, and thus it's something we can't say, well, I'm more righteous than you because I'm married. Well, I'm more righteous than you because I'm unmarried. No. Both are just the gift of God to help both situations avoid the temptation and the sin of fornication. And so I think that, you know, Barrett's explanation there is very good. Some avoid sexual temptation through the gift of celibacy, others through the gift of marriage. But both are gifts from God. And then in verses 8 and 9 he says, but I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them to remain even as I am, but if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So now he has been speaking to the married, now he refers to the unmarried and the widows. There's some question about what he means by unmarried. There's a good case to be made that unmarried refers to widowers. The Greek apparently didn't have, they had a word, but it wasn't common to use for widowers, whereas they had a very common word for widows, and we see that here. And so Paul very likely could be speaking not of unmarried as in virgins and widows, but in widowers and widows. Remember, he's been talking about man and woman the whole way through, husband and wife. So it makes sense that he's talking about widower and widower here, especially since there's another section later on where Paul specifically addresses the topic of those that are virgins. That would be those that are unmarried and have never been married. But whether or not that's the case, he turns his attention now to those that are unmarried for whatever reason. And regarding these people, Paul regarding married people, Paul disagrees that it's good for them to abstain from sexual relations from one another. But regarding the unmarried, he can see that there may be some good in them remaining unmarried. He's going to discuss some of the benefits that come along with celibacy later in this chapter, so we won't discuss that right now. But again, that does not make them spiritually better. Simply, there are advantages that the unmarried can use in their service to the Lord. Now, while it may be good for the unmarried to remain unmarried and exercise those advantages that they have in service to the Lord, what would not be good is for them to do so if they burn with passion and if that passion leads to temptation and fornication. So really the thrust of verse 8 is Paul is addressing those that might share his state of being unmarried but who do not share his gift of natural celibacy. Thus, for those individuals, they should not place themselves in spiritual danger. Instead, Paul's advice is they should marry. Now, there's question, does the burn refer to passion? Clearly, the New King James translators felt that it was. That with passion is not in the Greek. It ends with the word burn. But it could mean burn with passion, and that would be a right translation. Or could it be burn with judgment? Well, there's debate about that. Contextually, it seems that the idea of passion is what is in Paul's mind. But the truth is, if one burns with passion and allows that to lead them into temptation and lust and then acts upon that passion and commits fornication, then they are in great danger of also burning in judgment. And so both really could apply. And so Paul finishes with the unmarried in that case. Now, as I figured, I'm not going to get through verse 16 tonight. And so what we'll do is we'll wrap up with verse 9 right there, because verse 10 really sets apart the next subsection. Paul's going to go back to the married, and he's going to talk to two classes of married people. You say, how are there two classes of married people? Well, there's Christians married to Christians, and there's Christians married to non-Christians. And Paul has essentially the same command for both of them, but both of those situations need to be treated in a little bit different way. And so Paul will address both of those situations in verses 10 through 16. Lord willing, what we'll do is next Sunday evening, I'll teach on those verses in verses 10 through 16. But for now, let's go ahead and draw our sermon to a close. I hope that what I've said here this evening has been helpful in understanding this passage. Now, this is maybe not the normal passage that we spend a great deal of time reading or studying or teaching from, but I do think it's an important passage, because one thing that we can never study and meditate upon too much is family and our duties to one another as a husband and a wife, and of course as mothers and fathers. It's why recently I started a series on the family. And so I hope that this has been helpful in some way. And I hope that it, if nothing else, gives us some very serious consideration about how we view not just the physical portion of our marriage, but all aspects of our marriage. The physical, the mental, the spiritual, how we serve our spouse. And take an honest account. Is the way that I treat my spouse with expectation of what I can get, or with the desire of what I can lovingly give? Again, in all measures. Because that's the ideal for the Christian spouse. That's the ideal for both spouses, but especially for the Christian spouse. That should always be our focus. That takes work and that takes effort. But I hope that our study tonight has helped us in that regard in some way. We don't want to close without extending the invitation. So if there's one here who has not obeyed the gospel and would like to do so, we would invite you to take this opportunity to come, believing in Christ, repenting of your sins, confessing the name of Christ, and being baptized for the remission of your sins. Or if there's one here who would like to make a confession of faults, we would be happy to assist you by praying with you and for you at this time. So if there be one of either case, please come while we stand and while we sing.